From the KGOU studios, I'm Suzette Grelot, the Dean of the College of International Studies at the University of Oklahoma, and welcome to Worldviews. Joshua Landis joins me again this week to discuss the International Olympic Committee easing restrictions on refugee athletes and a recent International Monetary Fund report detailing the effect declining oil prices could have on Middle East cash reserves.
It will test these monarchies, which have been stable because they had so much money, they don't tax the people.
Then I'll talk with Leslie Woodward, one of the founders of the Post-Conflict Research Center in Sarajevo. Her organization works to ease the two-decade-old wounds of the wars in the Balkans.
We tell the stories of our youth and the kinds of struggles that they have that are related to the legacy of war that has been left behind.
A conversation about using multimedia to create a sustainable peace in Bosnia. But first, this hour's news. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzette Grelot. Joshua Landis, there's an interesting report this week that has come out from the IMF, the International Monetary Fund, suggesting that Saudi Arabia is going to run out of cash in about 5 years. Of course, this is all a result of low oil prices. We're now at around $45 to $50 a barrel. And of course, Saudi Arabia is the world's largest oil exporter and has enormous cash reserves, but yet they're not going to be able to maintain their current spending and their current programming and running their country on oil that's that low. So they're looking now to cut spending. I mean, this is all kind of dangerous territory for Saudi Arabia, being one country in the region that kind of escaped the whole Arab Spring. So what are we to make of this? What are its options and what can we expect from Saudi Arabia moving forward?
Well, you're absolutely right. Saudi Arabia has a very high expenses. Its spending for this year's budget is $229 billion, but it's going to have a big shortfall of almost $40 billion. And we don't really know. That's the stated figures. But with a war in Yemen and supporting a war in Syria and also subsidizing the Egyptian regime by over $10 billion a year, Saudi Arabia has giant expenses, and it's believed that its money that it has to be getting is about $100 a barrel in order to
break even. To break even, they have to have $100 a barrel oil.
And they're the worst in the Gulf because Kuwait break-even price is about $49. So they're okay.
But Kuwait's a small country.
Yes,
Kuwait's
it is.
A small country. Qatar, UAE, I mean, they're not doing – they're doing okay, but they're small countries compared
they're
to Saudi Arabia.
They're very small population. Saudi Arabia, about 30 million people. And they're small countries, and they haven't spent wildly. And that's partly because they're not into wars. But UAE, for example, very small country. I was just there this last week, a $73 break-even point. But they've got enough reserves, billions of dollars of reserves, that they can go out for 30 years at prices – where we are today. And so that's the, you know, that's the Brent crude average for next year is expected to be around $60, $61. Today it's about $47. So it's expected to go up, but it's still lower than the break-even point for many of these countries. And that's going to put incredible strain. And Iran is about 10 years, Saudi Arabia 5. So everybody at first, when prices fell, said, oh, Saudi Arabia is doing it intentionally in order to put pressure on Iran. But lo and behold, it's really Saudi Arabia that is spending like mad and is going to have to tighten its belt.
Well, I mean, I was going to ask about Iraq and Iran because those are two countries that are also going to suffer from this. But back, just to stay on Saudi Arabia for a minute, I mean, they also have you mentioned all the things that they're involved in the region, but they're also heavy spenders internally, domestically, a lot of social spending, a lot of support for their young people to leave the country and study around the world because
Saudi Arabia
they can't employ them at home. So, I mean, going back to this notion of a future, you know, Arab Spring in Saudi Arabia, I mean, if they really have to draw back on this spending and they only have 5 years of cash left in the bank, you know, what are we to expect in the terms of their political stability in the future?
Well, that's the million-dollar question about all the Gulf countries is they don't tax their people. Saudi Arabia does not tax. It has all this income coming straight out of the ground. So it gives subsidized mortgages, free education, free health care, you name it. It's free. It's a Republican dream in Saudi Arabia. No taxes and lots of government spending, I suppose. That's not the dream. But this is going to be a real problem because if this goes on for a long time, Saudi Arabia has to tax its people. And that will require democracy. You know, no taxation without representation was the American, you know, that's what did it over here and got rid of Britain. And so it will test these monarchies, which have been stable because they had so much money. They don't tax the people. It's a dream.
And the dream might be coming to an end sometime soon.
Well, unless prices go back up. And now Saudi Arabia can mortgage. They're getting into the bond market for the first time in a big way. You know, these articles saying they're going to go bankrupt in 5 years, don't believe it. Because they can borrow against that oil for many years to come. Other places are going to go bankrupt a lot sooner. And that's we're sitting on one of them.
Well, oil prices are a big issue for us as well. Well, just in the last couple of minutes, Joshua, I mean, I want to end on something interesting and positive here. The International Olympic Committee this week announced that refugees will, for the first time, be eligible for Olympic competition. So looking forward to the Olympics in Rio in 2016, they are welcoming refugee athletes. They will compete under the Olympic flag. I mean, there are about 20 million refugees around the world. Certainly some of them are fine athletes. The IOC is putting some money behind this. They've committed a couple million dollars to bring these refugees to the Olympics. So the question is are we able to see kind of some hope for these people? I mean, you study obviously Syria and the Middle East. There are a lot of great athletes in the region that have been affected by war. I mean, people around the world are affected by this. So maybe something hopeful and something we can look forward to here, something refugees can look forward to here.
Well, that's true. And I suppose in some ways, it'll encourage good athletes in poor countries to become refugees, and they will defect. This has happened already in Africa. I think most recently, Mugabe's rule, 10 athletes stayed in Spain. I forget where it was, but this is a problem. There are tons of good athletes that are trapped in their countries. And this will release them, in a sense, to look elsewhere.
Well, the International Olympic Committee, once again, making international political news in this regard, also calling for a truce for countries to end war during that period of time, during the Olympics. Of course, that's always been the way it is. But interesting news coming out from the IOC. All right. Well, Joshua, thank you again, as always, for being here for the roundtable on Worldviews. Thank you.
Always a pleasure. Thank you.
If you have any questions for Joshua or me, or comments about these topics, let us know by leaving comments on these stories in the Worldview section of our website, kgou.org. We're also on Twitter, @WorldviewsKGOU, and I tweet, @SuzekRolat. Joshua Landis posts regular updates, pictures, and links to his blog, Syria Comment, @Joshua_Landis. Next, I'll talk with Leslie Woodward. She's one of two founders of the Post-Conflict Research Center, an organization in Sarajevo that works to create sustainable peace in Bosnia and the entire Balkan region. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. This is Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat. My guest this half hour is Leslie Woodward. She's an Oklahoma City native who now works in Sarajevo as one of the co-founders of the Post-Conflict Research Center. She and her partner started the organization 4 years ago to create multimedia projects and tell stories that foster understanding and tolerance with a goal of creating lasting peace in the Balkans. Leslie Woodward, welcome to Worldviews.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Leslie, you've done some really impressive work in the fields of strategic peace building, post-conflict development, resolution. Tell us a little bit about how you got interested. You're from the state of Oklahoma. How you got interested in these things and ended up traveling the world studying issues like post-conflict peace building.
Absolutely. Actually, my journey started at Baylor University, and originally I was a biology major. So this was a little bit far off from what I ended up doing with my career. But during my time at Baylor, I had a chance to go to Kenya, where I was working on the ground in the slums and in different parts of Kenya with people that were afflicted with HIV and AIDS, orphans, and in particular, the group that moved me were the refugee women that I was working with. They had come from Somalia, Sudan, the Congo, and had escaped some really horrific situations without their husbands, oftentimes, to Kenya to start a new life with their children. And it was in Kenya that I really saw the resilience of the human spirit, and it really moved me to change my path a little bit. So I finished out my degree in biology and decided to go into international studies at the University of Denver. Because I wanted to keep my science background in play, I actually went into strategic peace building so that I could look at more of the mechanisms of creating a project, monitoring and evaluation processes, and project development, management of actual NGOs and things of that nature, a little bit more technical side. And it was during my studies there that I had the chance to go to Bosnia. I was working with an association for former concentration camp detainees. And that's when I met my soon-to-be partner, Velma, who is a Bosnian. She's a Bosnian Muslim who actually was a refugee during the war. And she had been working as a journalist for the past 8 years when I had met her. Really just an inspiring individual who objectively approached people's narratives and stories from all ethnic groups. And so when I met her, she had all of these ideas for projects. She was really creative, but she didn't know how to put things down on paper. And so because I had some experience volunteering and grant writing and actually being able to come devise a plan for how projects could go, I decided that I would help her in her endeavor. I didn't know it would be a long-term situation, but I decided that I would move to Bosnia shortly after graduating. And it was then that we started our organization about 4 years ago.
So this organization is the Post-Conflict Research Center.
Yes.
That you started. So what specifically are you working on in Bosnia in terms of the projects? Doing research, obviously, is what's indicated in your title, but obviously hands-on activities with the entire community in Bosnia, because you obviously have three communities, right? Just to remind us, the Bosnian Muslims you referred to, the mm-hmm. Croats, and the Serbs. And so kind of how what are the projects you work on to bring these communities together?
We have a lot of different approaches to creating a sustainable peace in Bosnia. And one of the approaches we have is storytelling. And we do that through a number of different methods. And that includes filmmaking, photography, investigative journalism. And we use those methods to oftentimes tell the stories and narratives of individuals who experienced a certain issue. So, for instance, we do stories about people who save the lives of others during times of war that we call ordinary heroes. We have documented the experiences of women who went through sexual violence and rape during the Bosnian conflict, and they tell their stories about the stereotypes and the stigma that they face on a day-to-day basis. We tell the stories of our youth and the kinds of struggles that they have that are related to the legacy of war that has been left behind, even though they may not have directly experienced the war. And we use these stories and these different ways of storytelling to bring really hard-hitting issues to the forefront. And we also like to have an approach that's a little bit more positive and hope-inspiring, because that's something that's often missing in Bosnian media. The media tends to focus on things that are very divisive, a lot of propaganda, a lot of very negative reportage. So we're trying to get into the media with some really positive stories about individuals who chose to make a difference in their communities. Another thing that we work on is educational programming. So we do a lot of training with members of the youth. And this could range anywhere from teaching them about moral courage, rescuer behavior, and active versus passive bystanders leadership and how you can become active in changing a situation for the better. Or it could be our multimedia training that we provide to the youth, where we train local correspondents from throughout the country to write for us for our media platform, Balkan Discourse. And we give them a topic every month. And we have about 15 kids who act as our local correspondents to discover stories from their own communities. And we do things like, for instance, the United Nations, where we actually assist in setting up workshops for civil society members on genocide prevention. And then the final thing we do is consultancy work. We have a lot of people coming in from the external communities, international communities, such as researchers. This is where our research comes in, because we facilitate research from all over the world to actually helping out with film work. We worked on Women, War, and Peace, which is a series by PBS, which focuses on women who changed the face of war during conflict. And one of the episodes was about Bosnia and how Bosnian women actually changed international law, making rape during conflict a crime against humanity. And we even worked with Angelina Jolie on her film In the Land of Blood and Honey. So those are the kinds of things we do in the consultancy realm.
I'm talking with Leslie Woodward, who grew up in Oklahoma City and now leads the Post-Conflict Research Center in Sarajevo. You can watch the trailer and find links to the Ordinary Heroes project she's been telling me about on our website, kgou.org. Let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. I'm Suzek Rolat, and this is Worldviews. You're listening to Worldviews. I'm Suzek Rolat, the dean of the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. This half hour, I've been speaking with Leslie Woodward. She's an Oklahoma City native who co-founded the Post-Conflict Research Center in Bosnia. When we left off, she described her organization's Ordinary Heroes project that tells stories of the lasting effects of the Balkan Wars during the 1990s. Their goal is to bring issues like sexual violence and the struggles children and teenagers face to the forefront and inspire hope for a sustainable peace in the region. Well, it's interesting to see that you're taking this type of approach, the positive approach, as you mentioned, the hope-inspiring approach, because we just marked not too long ago the 20th anniversary of Srebrenica, for example. And so recognizing and remembering, reminding ourselves that this wasn't that long ago, this massive war, this incredible genocide, and the hundreds of thousands of people that died in Bosnia, which I think your film and other products demonstrate. But again, just to think back about kind of how that concluded was to create a situation where the United Nations played a big role, still plays a big role in Bosnia and Herzegovina. And so tell us a little bit about, you mentioned you work a little bit with the UN, about its role there, and kind of bring us up to date and kind of what the status is, the political status of Bosnia is today, because it's such a complicated arrangement between these three parties, as we were talking before, and how the UN has helped or not create an independent society that's going to be productive and capable of integration in Europe in the future.
Right. Well, the most functional the UN is in Bosnia is through their individual branches. So, for instance, the UNDP, United Nations Development Program, or, United Nations Office of Genocide Prevention, who works directly on the ground. That's where they tend to be the most active and also the most successful. So there tends to be a different kind of view of the UN depending on where you are inside of Bosnia. So if you're in Republika Srpska, which is the Serb-dominated territory of Bosnia, you tend to have a much different view of the United Nations, and they have a hard time accessing those communities, which is something that we try to help them with since we're working on the ground. But if they are in the Federation, which is predominantly Croat and Bosniak, they face a lot of questions from the local populations about why they didn't step in during the war and why it took them so long to intervene. But people in general tend to have a little bit more of an accepting view in the Federation. In terms of the political situation, Bosnia is extremely complicated. There are three presidents from each of the different ethnic groups who rotate every 8 months. So it's really difficult to push policy through on any level. You also have a situation where you have two different entities. One is the Republika Srpska and one is the Federation, as I mentioned before. Those are actually physical boundaries that are separating different ethnic groups from each other and from interacting. And then you have 10 cantons that are inside the federation that all operate on their own agendas and on their own set of rules. And so things get extremely complicated, especially for people who work at a grassroots level and would like to access, let's say, for instance, the educational system. Well, each different sector and each different canton has their own rules about how to approach a school. And so we'll have to go through various levels of bureaucratic structure and permissions to even access a certain city or town or school. And the politicians in Bosnia, they oftentimes block us from doing our activities because the status quo is working for them. It profits them. They don't want to see things change because they're still profiting from the war. And so things are very corrupt in that sense.
So, I mean, this may not come as much of a surprise to some that are concerned about the big bureaucratic nature of the United Nations. I mean, I think that that's probably something a lot of people are concerned about, not just in Bosnia, but elsewhere. Nonetheless, they're keeping people apart, reducing tensions, trying to prevent a re-rise of nationalism. I mean, is that fair to say? I mean, despite the bureaucracy and some of the corruption that you're referring to, I mean, what would be the alternative, I guess, to this type of arrangement? And is there any way out of where they are now?
Well, the United Nations is doing a good job when they're doing their individual projects on the ground because they're really good at listening to local organizations and taking feedback from them. And they're trying to – I know our work with the United Nations Office of Genocide Prevention, what they're trying to do is they're trying to create some ways that the local communities can actually directly reach them to let them know about situations or rising tensions on the ground so that they can act. And we also, had some representatives from the United Nations attend Srebrenica genocide commemoration with us, and they were able to see firsthand that tensions are still high. Sometimes their hands are tied when it comes to maybe the bursts of violence that happened, just like with what happened last year with the government protesting that was happening in Bosnia about a year ago. They tend to step back from that. But when they're doing their grassroots approaches and listening to local organizations, they are having a lot of success in that area. And I would say a solution to, overcoming these ethnic barriers and these ethnic tensions is education of the youth. They're the ones that need to be educated so that they don't carry on the legacy of this war.
Well, Leslie, thank you so much for being here today and telling us a little something hopeful and positive about Bosnia. Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me.
You've been listening to my conversation with Leslie Woodward, an Oklahoma City native and one of the founders of the Post-Conflict Research Center in Sarajevo. There's much more information and links to their projects online at kgou.org. Our show is also available as a podcast through iTunes. Worldviews is a collaborative partnership between KGOU and the University of Oklahoma's College of International Studies. Sam Dupre put this episode together, Ivy Dyson wrote the web version of this story, and Brian Hardzinski oversees our production and digital efforts. For Joshua Landis, I'm Suzette Rolott.